Much has been made over the years by critics about the distinction between crime fiction and literary fiction. Genre novels have been characterised as the poor relations, limping and stuttering along behind their more sophisticated cousins with their elegant prose, their incisive characterisation, and their daring experiments with structure. If any concession is granted to the crime writer, it is that we know how to tell a story. But in recent years, that distinction has come under even greater pressure. Writers with impeccable literary credentials, such as Kate Atkinson, Louise Doughty and John Banville, have wrapped themselves in mystery and turned their hands to crime. Writers such as Graham McRae Burnett and Mary Paulson Ellis have emerged, whose work falls readily into neither camp. Is it a crime novel or a novel about a crime? And does it even matter as long as it's a good read? One of the earliest writers who blurred those lines was Muriel Spark. It would be foolish to attempt to categorise her as a crime writer, but there's no doubt that her work has affiliations to that genre. She both uses and subverts tropes and structures that readers are familiar with from crime fiction, and her novels bristle with characters familiar from crime novels. Frauds, thieves, policemen, private detectives, and psychologists. Ian Rankin has often spoken of being diverted from his PhD on Spark to write the first of his Detective Inspector John Rebus novels, and that's a deviation that is much less surprising than it might at first appear. After all, like so many of us crime writers, Spark wrote a book a year, more or less. When Memento Mori, regarded by many as Spark's masterpiece, was published in 1959, this is how the New York Times review began. It was G.K. Chesterton whose resourcefulness first showed us that literary conventions as frivolous-seeming as those of the detective story could be adapted to serious purposes. After him, novelists as different as Charles Williams and Graham Greene extended this strategy, borrowing mystery and thriller techniques to purvey human mysteries that would have seemed stiffly doctrinaire in any other form. The third generation of this distinctly British family has now appeared, and a bright young lady named Muriel Spark has mixed a touch of Agatha Christie with some of the swift, slightly brutal comedy of Evelyn Waugh to produce a novel about death that ought to tease, entertain and quietly perturb a wide variety of American readers. The cast of characters of Memento Mori is almost exclusively over the age of 70. Their lives are woven together in a tight and complicit web. They're plagued by a mysterious telephone caller who urges them to remember that they must die. It's a distant echo of the sinister newspaper notice that sets in motion Agatha Christie's A Murder is Announced. Ultimately, there is indeed a murder. There is also a retired police inspector who is summoned to unmask the threatening caller. Another distant echo, this time of Poirot and his little grey cells. But with Spark, what starts off looking like a rather mundane crime turns into a metaphysical mystery. And that is one of the trademark performances of Spark's fiction. It's a performance she was clearly conscious of herself. In the sinister and troubling 1970 novel, The Driver's Seat, she says, "It's a whydunit in Q-sharp major, and it has a message. Never talk to the sort of girls that you wouldn't leave lying about in your drawing room for the servants to pick up." Written with the terse precision of a police officer making a verbal report, The Driver's Seat reveals its end near its beginning. She will be found tomorrow morning dead from multiple stab wounds, her wrists bound with a silk scarf and her ankles bound with a man's necktie. Not for the first or last time, Spark offers her readers foreknowledge, not foreshadowing. It's a trick memorably repeated by Ruth Rendell in her novel A Judgment in Stone, which opens with the line, "Eunice Parchman killed the Coverdale family because she could not read or write." This experimentation with formal constraints is one of Spark's trademarks and what sets her apart from many of her contemporaries. She has a genuinely postmodern concern with the artifice of the novel, a concern which has roots both in her adopted Roman Catholicism and her wartime employment in the Department of Political Intelligence in the Foreign Office. Spark's work there involved black propaganda and the techniques of psychological warfare that were designed to undermine and subvert the morale of the German people. For 2 years, she was employed to dress up lies to look like truth. to make the most unlikely fiction seem credible. The perfect apprenticeship for a novelist, I'd have thought. Her conversion to Catholicism had an even more profound influence on the kind of writer she became. In her belief system, only God can create the world, so although she loved to play God in her novels, she felt obliged constantly to remind her readers that she was engaged in fiction and artifice rather than truth-telling. She's clever enough to make this work, mostly because she never reins in her powers as a storyteller. But in spite of her Catholicism, it seems to me that Spark as God had more in common with the Scottish Calvinism of her youth, a cruel jester who would allow you the illusion of being one of the chosen, only to pull the rug out from under your feet at the Last Judgment. Certainly, her black wit is much closer to the twisted gallows humour of contemporary Scottish crime writing. There's a wonderful moment in Memento Mori, where a character in her 50s is being unexpectedly diverted onto a path in a dark wood by her ex-lover. She comforts herself with this bleak thought. Were they not usually young women who were strangled in woods by sexual maniacs? I can't help feeling Spark would have enjoyed the darkness of writers like Chris Brookmyre and Stuart McBride. The question of evil, which also permeates much of contemporary Scottish crime writing, was something that runs through Spark's work too. In something that sounds like a manifesto for tartan noir, she wrote, I believe, as Cardinal Newman claimed, that it is impossible to write a novel that does not contain evil if one is writing about human beings and their destiny. Evil is absolutely necessary for dramatic presentation. A novel without evil would be like the white of an egg without the yolk. Insipid. She set out her stall both in terms of her concern with the dark side of human nature and her interest in formal experimentation right at the start of her career as novelist. Her debut novel, The Comforters, features a gang of diamond smugglers, although they are much less disturbing than most of her miscreants. The gang is led by a grandmother. They smuggle the diamonds in plaster statuettes of saints and loaves of bread. It's more Marjorie Allingham and the Lavender Hill Mob than Hitchcock. But the secondary plot centres round an exploration of form in the modern novel, with the appearance of the typing ghost, who insists that the central character, Caroline, is herself nothing more than a character in the novel she's writing. Spark's own life had been plagued by difficult events over which she felt she had no control. A violent husband, grinding poverty, broken relationships, people who exploited her, and anxieties that drove her to a nervous breakdown. It's not surprising that she wanted to exercise control over the characters she created as a counterpoint to all that. And she never abandons her role as the puppet master who exerts control over her characters and their stories. It's an artificiality that also permeates much of the golden age of detective fiction. Characters do only what they are permitted to do and no more. Muriel Spark would never, ever have said, "The characters just took on a life of their own." One of the ways Spark maintained that control was to insert herself into the books. As well as the detached narrator, there is usually one character who stands for Spark herself, a cipher for the qualities most crucial to her. Those characters are observers, watchful, insightful, gatherers of secrets, judgmental, brisk, logical, detached and waspish in their humour. All characteristics that mark out the investigator, the person charged with getting to the heart of whatever mystery is apparently to be solved. Except that in Spark's novels, as the detective says to his wife in Memento Mori, if you look for one thing, you frequently find another. The downside of that tight control is that the books remain intellectual puzzles, which of course is a criticism often aimed with some justification at those early writers of detective fiction. Spark refuses to grant us much in the way of access to the inner lives of her characters. In The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, for example, we hear many of Miss Brodie's pronouncements. They've become catchphrases we still use, Maggie Smith's diction ringing in our ears. A woman in her prime. My girls are the creme de la creme. Give me a girl at an impressionable age and she's mine for life. We see Miss Brodie's reactions, and the reactions of others to her. Much of the external elements of her life are described, but in so many of the ways that matter, we don't know Gene Brody at all. There is another crossover element between Spark and the Golden Age detective novel, which can also be seen as a way of maintaining control. Just as Agatha Christie and P.D. James use closed environments to limit their suspect groups, so Spark often uses a similar method of containment. The closed world becomes its own universe, with outside events seldom impinging. With Spark, these worlds are women-only spaces where men are admitted as exotic creatures whose behaviour is darkly unpredictable and often treacherous. So we have the May of Tech Girls Residential Club in The Girls of Slender Means, the Marcia Blaine Girls' School in The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, the geriatric ward in Memento Mori, where the women are stripped of their identities and referred to generically as grannies, the convent in The Abbess of Crewe, and so on. Somewhere in all of those Edens lurks a serpent, capable of having them all cast into outer darkness. When it comes to noir fiction, there is one staple element that never ceased to fascinate Spark. Those uncomfortable tangles of sex and violence, perhaps a legacy from her own disastrous marriage. There is a kind of sadism in her work that reminds me at times of her close contemporary, Patricia Highsmith. There's an aloofness in both women's writing, as if they're observing us without being one of us. Both had the reputation of being prickly, of falling out with people for the slightest of reasons. Someone said of Spark that she went through people like Kleenex. There is an air of mistrust in their work, a disdain for the concerns of mere mortals, and an unsettling interest in torturing characters, displaying them like butterflies on a pin. It's a stance that can send as much of a chill through us as the most unsettling suspense novel. I don't know a crime writer who wouldn't have loved to have written the opening line of the short story, The Portobello Road. He looked as if he would murder me, and he did. The narrator is a ghost, of course, prefiguring Alice Siebold's wildly successful The Lucky Bones by the best part of 20 years. And who doesn't envy this exchange from Robinson? "Tom Wells nearly killed me," I said.
"That would not have been serious for you," he said. "You've got to die sometime."
It would have been serious for Wells. Tempting, though, it is for me as a crime writer to claim Muriel Spark as one of us. It's manifestly a reach too far. But what is clear is that there are threads of affiliation that stretch back from Spark to the defining golden age of detective stories and forward to the thriving world of contemporary Scottish crime writing, both thematically and formally. Writers such as Kate Atkinson, Denise Mina, Graham McRae Burnett and Mary Paulson Ellis reveal that continuity in their work. But the last word must go to Muriel Spark herself. "You have to live with the mystery," she said. "That's the answer in my books."